This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, everything that Tom, Rich and myself have been up to on a Thursday morning. A Thursday morning in which we've had an interview with the CEO of Etihad. Richard has been down the road in Abu Dhabi speaking to a man, not just about a plane, but about a potential IPO. We've also had a really interesting report come out from Insight Discovery suggesting that the number of wealth management firms registered and operating here in the UAE rose by more than a third last year. Is that actually good for us, though, as the investing public? That's what we've asked the man behind it, Nigel Sillitoe. We've also had the big boss, it's been a day for CEOs, of MoneyGram International in the studio, talking to Tom about where remittance flows are going. And RERA's getting tough on brokers who leave up listings that have effectively expired. Apartments that have been rented, villas that have been sold, 50,000 dirhams in fines is what you'll get for each one. We've been asking Gil van Gelder why they're being left up in the first place.
Business Breakfast, packed show for you today. Let's dive straight into those top business stories. Etihad Airways yesterday, full year earnings out, 525 million dirhams profit. Now that's good. It's not great, but it's good given the tough run that Etihad's had over the past few years. You could say, really, over the past couple of decades. I spoke with the CEO, Antonio Neves, yesterday. Went down to Etihad headquarters. He was speaking to a lot of the media, to be fair, and had a chat about a bunch of stuff. But what I really wanted to ask him about was the potential IPO. Because, Brandy, you remember the story that broke over the weekend. Bloomberg had the story, didn't they?
That ADQ were speaking to people who were Benki-type people who might help.
About a possible Etihad IPO. And I was going down there yesterday and we were chatting beforehand. Oh, you got to ask him about the IPO. And I was thinking, well, I'll ask him. He's not going to talk about it, is he? Because chief executives don't. They say, oh, well, we don't comment on rumour and speculation.
Spoiler, he did talk about it.
But the question you really wanted to ask was blah, 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 blah. No. He's sung like a canary, did Antonaldo. This is a brief excerpt of his response to the IPO question. And it was not a flat out no.
IPOs are always fascinating, right? People love to talk about it. But if you go one level below, right, and the surface, it's not a destination. I mean, it's not a place where we get to. It's just a start, right? I mean, it's not even the start. IPO is just another tool to have access to the capital markets. I have access to debt, I have access to leasings, right? Operational leasings, you have access to the to shareholders, right, that we have today. So the way we see that WIM management, right, is I need to be ready so that whenever the shareholder decides is a good time to do it, we do it.
We'll hear more from Antonaldo a little bit later on, and he explains that it's not just about the airline being ready, but the environment being right as well in terms of, you know, markets, economy, etc., cash. The one thing I did think when you took off yesterday to go down and see him, because we knew that the earnings were coming out from Etihad as well, I thought, well, the earnings are going to be pretty good then, because the rule of thumb with airlines in this region is that if you just get sent a press release, they're not great. If you get invited over for a cuppa and a biscuit, you know they're going to be good.
There's an element in truth in what you say. They were good numbers for Etihad. Even he says in the interview, look, they weren't spectacular numbers. I mean, Air Arabia made three times more profit than Etihad did. And Air Arabia is a small, but it's a low-cost carrier. But the direction of travel for Etihad is in the right direction. All four of the UAE airlines making profit last year, which is good to see. Now, wealth management. The economy's booming and we are like flies round a honeypot. The wealth management companies are here in the UAE, Brandy.
Yeah, the theory is that they're following the population, particularly the population that's moving into the UAE with money. Nigel Sillitoe is founder and CEO of Insight Discovery. They've just put out a big report looking at a lot of aspects of the industry, but what we were most interested in was the part that touches us most directly, and therefore the people who listen to and watch us. And that's the people who deal with those who are investing less than $1 million. Let's start with a headline number, though. The number of wealth management firms regulated in this country was up more than a third last year. I asked Nigel this morning, is that good or is that bad?
probably more competition for the existing firms here, but I think it reflects the growth of the UAE and particularly firms regulated in the two main financial centres, DIFC and ADGM.
Is there room for everyone? Are they all going to survive?
If the population keeps growing as it is, then yes, I think there will be. This is still quite a small number relative to, let's say, other financial centres per million of population. But I do find it staggering that there are now something like 240 firms regulated within the GCC. And actually, 201 of these are in the UAE alone, which proves that the UAE is the centre for wealth management.
But does it make sense if we're just talking about chasing the population? We know there's been mammoth population growth in terms of expatriates in Saudi Arabia. Why aren't we then seeing more fund management firms set up there?
That's partly because the regulation has been slower, but that's changing because as of this year, if you are looking to raise assets from institutions, you have to have your head office regulated in Saudi. So that will affect the very big global managers, but for a personal wealth manager, I'm sure Dubai will still remain the centre.
The other big number for me that came out of this report was the fact that the sort of do-it-yourself investment platforms, the SAWAs, the Interactive Brokers, the SwissQuotes, the number that were registered here grew by a quarter in the last year. And indeed, if you have walked in Gate Avenue under DIFC, where you see the electronic billboards, there's a humongous amount of ads for new platforms, the eToros and all the rest of them, that have set up, suggesting potentially that more of us are doing it for ourselves.
Nigel Solito, the CEO and co-founder of Insight Discovery.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
So Etihad Airways reporting net profit of 525 million dirhams for last year. That's modest compared to UAE rivals Emirates Fly Dubai and Air Arabia, but it is up sharply from the previous year. I sat down with the chief executive, Antonaldo Neves, yesterday at Etihad headquarters in Abu Dhabi, and I began by asking him about those rising profits. To what extent is this a rising tide lifting all boats, and how much of it is internal?
It's a fair point. It's a very, very good point. I mean, most of the airlines in the world are making money, right? It's a good time for airlines. I mean, you have on one hand, main economies growing, so GDP growing. So I don't think it's more COVID related, right? I mean, GDP is growing, right? And on the other hand, I mean, we're constrained because we don't have planes. Right, so supply and demand is clearly not balanced. We're operating right now on load factors. I mean, we did 85% last year. I mean, in March right now, year to date, 92%. It's crazy. I've never seen that before, right? So, but we're doing better than competition on loads. So I would say it's a combination of both, right? So on one hand, I mean, the supply and demand is working well for everyone. On the other hand, I think Etihad is improving a lot. So, I mean, the fact that I have better load factors today than my competition, it speaks for itself, right? The fact that we're growing a lot and in a very quick pace, right? The fact that we're cutting costs, right? I mean, this is not the market. You said, I mean, our unit cost is going down by 7%. So I think there is also credit that is deemed to our people and to our workers.
Yeah, you deserve credit. When profit goes up, you deserve the credit. But if we break down that increase in passenger numbers, interesting to know who's flying. A lot of the noise we're getting out of, particularly North America and Europe, is that high-end business passengers, maybe not quite back to pre-pandemic levels, but this new affluent consumer, passengers who want to fly close to the pilot, is actually quite an important driver of those high-yielding seats. You seeing any of that here?
Yeah, it's happening. It's business class load factor last year was 80%. Corporate customers are not back to the level they were in 2019. So you're precisely correct. I mean, we see that, we feel that, we touch that every day, right? So it's a good market. I mean, it's and the region is doing very well. If you think about the region, right? I mean, it's not the same across the globe, right? You have some yield pressure in the U.S. right now. You have a lot of inflation in Europe. I mean, we are in a very unique position. I mean, within 4 hours, 5 hours flight, 2.4 billion people and growing. I mean, I've been here for 1.5 years now.
Abu Dhabi today is totally different than Abu Dhabi 1 year and a half ago, right? I mean, you can see that.
So in terms of the profitability, half a billion-ish dirhams on 20 billion-ish dirhams of revenue, that's a margin of 2% by my basic maths, which is good. I mean, is Etihad still in a turnaround situation, or have we exited that now?
I don't like to use the word turnaround because it looks like the job is done. You see what I mean? And this is my third airline. I was the CEO of an airline in South America, right? Where you have a crisis every other year, right? And we think you're done, you're not done, right? I was the CEO of a legacy carrier in Europe, right? Very hard to make change, right? I mean, airline is a difficult business. It's not an easy business, not for the faint of heart, right? So, I mean, the day you think the turnaround is done, I mean, competition kills you, right? So, I mean, we need to keep our eyes open. I agree with you, it's a good result. It's not an extraordinary result. Right, even though, I mean, we did an extraordinary job this year, right, because the base was very low, right? So the improvement in margin was spectacular, right? There's still more to do. So I do believe that doing a little bit every year on a very fast pace is going to put us among the best and the most profitable airlines in the world in the future, but it will take more time, right? And when we get there, we'll have to do it more and more and more and more because it's airlines, right? You can never rest.
So there is some scrutiny on these numbers now. There's journalists like me, there's your board of directors, but you can fit them in a room. What if you became a listed company? You will be aware of the Bloomberg story that came out over the past few days about a potential IPO for Etihad. I'm sure you've been asked the question many times. I'm going to ask it as well. What can you tell us?
So, I mean, I've done it before, right? I listed Azul. Azul was listed in the New York Stock Exchange, an amazing success. It was, 2017. We've done many, many M&A transactions in my career. The thing I IPOs are always fascinating, right? People love to talk about it. But if you go one level below, right, and the surface, it's not a destination. I mean, it's not a place where we get to. It's just a start, right? I mean, it's not even the start. IPO is just another tool to have access to the capital markets. I have access to debt, I have access to leasings, right? Operational leasings, you have access to the shareholders, right? That we have today. So the way we see that with management, right, is I need to be ready so that whenever the shareholder decides is a good time to do it, we do it. And it's very easy, right? When the shareholder decides to do it, they file for that and it becomes public. And any IPO, right, you're going to know 1 month in advance when it becomes public, right? So we're not at that stage now, right? The shareholder has not filed. But we have the obligation as management, right, to improve governance, to improve the balance sheet, to improve the P&L of the company, to have a strategy for the long term, so that when the day comes, we do it. Azul took me 4 times. I only did at the 4th time because it doesn't depend only on our will. We need to have a market that is vibrant. You need to have investors that are willing to invest. You need to have an equity story so that investors, they buy the equity story. And you need to have a company that is functioning well. I think we're working hard to check all these boxes, right? But you only know it when you do it. So as of now, I mean, it's still in the speculation phase, right? I mean, and it's rewarding for me and for my people that years ago in the news, right, the speculation was Etihad is going to be sold to a competitor, right? Etihad is going to go out of business, right? So it's really flattering to see that the speculation now is about an IPO because that shows that these numbers that we're publishing, right, they have some reasoning, they are sound, and they provide us with the basis for the future. If we're going to do it or not, time will tell.
Let's talk about getting planes. It seems you have very little difficulty selling tickets and winning passengers, but what about aircraft? For people watching on TV, behind us now, there's a model of an Etihad aircraft.
It's not a real plane.
It's not a real plane. But you can buy models, but you can't buy planes at the moment. It's very, very hard. How do you characterize the challenges, particularly with Boeing, but not just Boeing?
I tell you, you can buy planes, but they don't deliver, right? They're selling a lot. They keep selling. It's a big challenge. It's a serious problem. I think
first and foremost, is a problem for the industry, right? Because we're missing opportunities as an industry. I mean, we could be growing much more. It's not only Boeing, it's Boeing and Airbus. It's the entire industry, right? And I think, I mean, the manufacturers have to reconsider the way they're managing that, because they keep selling, and they don't deliver. It's a shame, right? And in the end, I mean, the industry could be much better, much stronger if planes were arriving, right? So it's frustrating.
Etihad Chief Executive Antonaldo Neves. The good news, profit rising at the airline to just over $500 million last year. The bad news, demand is booming, but they haven't got enough planes, as Antonaldo explained to me when I went down to Abu Dhabi to speak to him yesterday.
And this is a big global problem. It's not only Boeing, it's Boeing and Airbus. It's the entire industry, right? And I think, I mean, the manufacturers have to reconsider the way they're managing that, because they keep selling, and they don't deliver. It's a shame, right? And in the end, I mean, the industry could be much better, much stronger if planes were arriving, right? So it's frustrating.
What about non-Airbus and Boeing? Singapore Air Show, all the noise was about COMAC, the Chinese narrow-bodied aircraft. Embraer, of course, out of South America, your part of the world. They make aeroplanes.
They do, and I mean, I'm very familiar with ATRs. I had the largest fleet of ATR in the world. It's an amazing plane. I had one of the largest fleets of, actually it was the largest fleet of Embraer 190s in the world. I had more than 90 of those planes in Brazil.
Great planes.
The 220 is a great plane, right? It was Bombardier before. I mean, I don't know about the COMAC. Not that I don't know that I'm questioning, but I have never invested time trying to understand the plane. So it's a brand new plane. So I cannot comment on that with experience. But you're right. I mean, the world has other manufacturers. The only issue is that the segment, those manufacturers, they play, they don't match with our network. I mean, I would love to have other alternatives, right? But reality is the 190s or the 220s are too small for Etihad. In 4 hours, we have 2.4 billion people here, right? I need planes that can carry about 190, 200 passengers. I need some business class seats. So maybe for other markets, right, they're going to play a role. But in our case, unfortunately, we given our geographic position, it's not unfortunately, right? It's just a condition. We don't have the chance, but maybe one day these people, these other manufacturers are gonna build great narrow bodies and great wide bodies, and then competition is gonna happen to help the sector.
Who knows? Maybe your friends up the road in Alain will build one as well and surprise us.
Who knows, right?
Maybe in our lifetime. Some of the challenges that you may face more long term. I was chatting with one aviation consultant this morning, Vinam Rolongani, great guy, know him well. One of his three mega trends for the industry going forward is people don't want to connect. They want to go point to point. Etihad and the other Gulf carriers, connection is in your DNA. It's the lion's share of what you do. What happens when Air India under Tata has a really good service going direct from Mumbai to London and so on?
It's not point to point or connections. Every time we start connecting, you promote aviation, and then point-to-point comes. So let's look at Dubai. What happened in Dubai? In the past, was primarily a connecting market. Now there's a lot of point-to-point in Dubai. I was shocked, right, with the numbers. UAE today is bigger than Brazil in terms of passengers per year. Few people are talking about that. Isn't that mind-blowing? Brazil has 220 million people. 100 million passengers per year. We have more in the UAE than in Brazil. So is it a mega hub? Of course it is. But look how big is the local demand in Dubai. So my view is that these things, they come hand in hand. Why? Because it's the nature of competition, right? Of course Air India is going to do a nonstop. And they should. But you know what? Connecting is going to be cheaper. But you know what? Connecting, people that are in India can clear immigration in Abu Dhabi. And there are people that value that. You see what I mean? So it's always like that, right? The connecting flights are cheaper. If you go and see the U.S. market, right? The US market over the past 10, 15 years, even Southwest is connecting people. There's only two pure point-to-point players today in the market, right? Swiss Air in Europe and Ryanair in Europe, right? Lufthansa is a huge network carrier. So I don't think it's one or the other, right? I think both models are going to evolve. And in some phases, Etihad is going to be doing more point-to-point. In other phases, Etihad is going to be doing more. It depends on how the network evolves. It's not a static. So we just announced Jaipur in India, right? So we're building that market, right? One day, if we build that market in a way that is so big, someone's going to put a nonstop from Jaipur to somewhere. You see what I mean? And that's the nature, right? That's the nature. And so I do believe it's going to evolve hand in hand. Sometimes the emphasis is going to be more on point-to-point. Sometimes the network care in the network. It depends on competition. So I'm honestly not worried about that tension right now because I think it's part of the business.
Just quickly before we wrap up, comments from yourself, but also your chairman in the release today. He says, our vision is to be the airline that everyone wants to fly. Well, which chairman wouldn't say that? But what does that look like? You say you want it to be an extraordinary experience. That costs money. I want a bowling alley and a gym in my economy class.
But this statement that our chairman is putting on the press release is so simple and at the same time is so deep, right? Let me elaborate on that. It's not like any other comment. I mean, this is enrooted in our mission, right? And I really mean that. And let me explain you. This is behind our strategy, right? I mean, we don't have the scale of other airlines, right? I don't, period, right? So I cannot afford to lose one customer. And I have to face reality. I compete in Rome, flying to Rome, with low cost. So Etihad today, round trip to Rome is $375. Go Google it, right? And why is that? Because I have competition. So the way we view our strategy is the following. We have to have great customer experience. We have to have the lowest possible cost we can have at a very high quality service, right? We have to have a good network so that we provide a good network for our customers. But I need to be able to segment the plane. I have to have a value proposition that my guy that is willing to go in the front, right, in a first class seat, is going to have the best service one can have in the airline industry in those 2-4 rows that I have with first class. I have to have a business class that is amazing, beautiful, neat, that speaks to that customer as you just described it, right? But you know what? The last 4 rows, I need to be able to fight the low cost competition. So why can't I segment my plane in a way that I have a different offer and that I can become the choice of each and every customer that is willing to fly from point A to point B?
Last question, 2030, big focus for you since you've been here 18 months. Well, it's half a decade away now. What's Etihad going to look like in numbers? Number of planes, number of passengers, revenue, pick a number.
So we believe we can do about 30 to 33 million passengers in 2030. So this is 3 times bigger than we did just in 2022, right? So we're going to triple the number of customers. The fleet is going to be twice as big. So it's a little bit counterintuitive, right? But it's going to be twice as big, but the utilization is going to be higher. So instead of using 8 hours per day at 320, I'm going to be using 12, 13 hours per day at 320, right? So double the size of fleet, triple the number of passengers.
Those the thoughts then of Antonoaldo Neves, who is the Group Chief Executive Officer of Etihad Airways.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Stop remittances, if we can, always a topic that garners a lot of reaction from our listeners. MoneyGram International provides payment services across the world. They are a global service. They've been going through some big changes in the last year and a half or so. In fact, what was it, last June that it went private? Then, of course, new board of directors bought on, new focus, new vision as well. The firm's become one of the biggest digital money transfer organisations in the region. A lot of that's down to the chairman and CEO, Alex Holmes, who's back here in the region and joining us live here this morning. Alex, good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Thanks for having me back.
We know that remittance flow has continued to grow year on year. We saw that last year, predictions again for this year as well. Are we seeing sort of similar rises? I sort of see the figure of about 3% being the prediction. Are we seeing similar rises here in the region?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the corridor. It depends on the activity. I think you hit it earlier. You know, the Egyptian pound situation is certainly causing some difficulties for Egyptians at the moment. Focus on, you know, U.S. dollar sends and sort of changing the way in which, you know, consumers interact. But definitely we continue to see increases in remittance growth. MoneyGram in particular is doing extremely well in the region right now, so we're very proud of that. It's, you know, the center of tech innovation here, you know, being in the Middle East is absolutely fantastic, sort of a global revolution, if you will. You know, we've gone globally to 55% of our transactions are now digitized. Here in the GCC, it's about 80%. So, you know, phenomenal trends and definitely continuing to focus on that end-to-end customer experience, which makes a huge difference for our customers.
Yeah, because for a long time, you know, this region has been, well, remittances have been a large part of the economy. A lot of people come here to work, send money home to families and communities as well. Therefore, has it sort of been important to the global policies that you put in place in recent times, the region as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the social responsibility that comes with the commitment that each individual, you know, consumer makes when they leave home to find opportunity for employment, send money back, and take care of their families. And so when you think about the importance of that, the cost of remittances is a huge focus. Mm-hmm. MoneyGram is very proud to sort of lead the world in cost reductions globally, below 3%, 2.85% on average, which is, I think, you know, beating the standard around the world, meeting the UN sustainability, you know, development requirements, and, you know, putting forward the right products and services. You know, many years ago, as you said, it was about walk in, send cash, go, you know, and today it's, I mean, it is monumentally different. Send, you know, send digitally, go to many different apps. You've got the Bodom app here. You've got, you know, EN Money, Pay It out of Abu Dhabi. They're, you know, great examples. We just signed in Saudi with Barak, which is going to be, you know, transformational again, I think, for the market. They're going to push, you know, a new, you know, payroll type card wage protection system directly into the payroll. So you send from that app. So, I mean, you're just seeing monumental shifts in the market and the way that the consumers are touching. And then on the receive side, sending to wallets, sending into bank accounts, still being able to pick up cash. So it's tremendously differentiated now.
To that end, and part of that progressive innovation that you're talking about at the moment, especially when things are evolving and moving so fast in the digital and the digitization phases, how important are partnerships and collaborations for you?
Oh, for us, it's everything, right? I mean, you've got to get from point A to point B. So we literally have hundreds of thousands of partners around the world. We have a global cash network with still 450,000 outlets. We plug into well over, you know, 4 or 5 billion bank accounts, mobile wallets. 150 countries are digitized for us now. So it's absolutely critical that we have a great product, a great service. The reason that money moves as quickly as it does because of companies like MoneyGram. We're able to instantly provide those payments because of the partners we have both on the send and the receive side. So it's absolutely critical that we've got great partners, and the selection of those partners makes a big difference. Again, coming back to customer experience, it's sort of that end-to-end, you know, the consumers have to trust that the money's going to get where it's supposed to be, and it's got to get there quickly, reliably. So speed, convenience, and that trust factor comes in a major way. So
those relationships, collaborations, are key to the sort of the growth of the business and with tech and other providers as well. From a brand perspective as well, how do you push the MoneyGram brand around the world? Is there an evolution going on there?
Yeah, I'm so excited you asked that question because, you know, we saw a huge partnership yet last year. We started with Formula One. So, you know, we're definitely very proud of the MoneyGram Haas F1 team. We did pretty well in Bahrain last weekend and obviously off to Jeddah. And we'll see how we do today and into Saturday. But very exciting. We saw an 11-point improvement in global brand awareness last year lift just from the Formula One sponsorship. So it's been absolutely transformational for us, and we're continuing to push that global brand awareness. And one of the initiatives we have this year is obviously to continue to leverage that, but also to try to bring our customers into the fold as well. We had some really exciting things last year, dream giveaways, enabling a young man from Nepal, a lovely lady from Peru, actually had a chance to get on the track, meet drivers, and be part of that. And because of their interaction with MoneyGram, we're able to push that forward. And so it's just been absolutely wonderful experience for us.
Just finally, what have I got? About 30 seconds left with you, Alex, on this one before the news. Obviously, a little bit of uncertainty out there, a few choppy waters at the moment. What's the MoneyGram International house view for 2024, especially given that economic outlook?
Yeah, I think choppy is a good way to look at it. I think it's going to be a bit up and down. I think inflationary pressures, increased... increased costs across the board, increased responsibilities, AML, KYC, all these important drivers. So we're very bullish, though, on 2024. We've got a very aggressive agenda ahead of us, a lot to do here. It's sort of a key critical year for us. So we're very excited about that opportunity. But obviously, got to keep that economic uncertainty sort of, in the backdrop of our heads every morning. So we'll keep our heads down and keep pushing forward.
One eye on the FX markets, one eye on the F1 as well. It's all happening, that's for sure. Listen, can't thank you enough. I know it's a busy time for you, but really appreciate you coming in early this morning to the studio.
Absolutely.
Alex Holmes, Chairman and CEO of MoneyGram International, we thank you. This is The Business Breakfast.
Just the highlights. This is The Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We are fighting fake listings, or to be charitable, listings that might have been real but no longer relevant. We've got a warning from RERA that they need to update listings within 3 days. Gil van Gelder is a sales director for Espace Real Estate. Gil, good morning. It's lovely to see you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, what's RERA asking you all to do?
So, RERA back in February gave all real estate agencies a warning to remove all fake, sold, rented, and primary developer stock from all property portals, websites, social media campaigns.
Why did they do that?
I think they're just wanting to enhance the consumer confidence and experience, really. It's all down to the consumer. I think it's beneficial for everyone down the end. I know us agencies are all trying to capture leads, but from a consumer point, it's just to create more of a real perspective on the real estate market.
So what was happening? What's the situation that RERA is preventing here?
They're preventing... Well, they want...
Or tackling.
Yeah, or tackling. So they want to give the consumer a bit more confidence in the real estate market and give more transparency into the real estate market, I'd say. If, for example, a few months ago, you would look at any community, let's take, for example, the Meadows, for example. If you did a search on a villa for Meadows, there'd probably be over 250 properties come online for sale, when the reality is there's probably around 50 to 60 properties on the market, right? So it gives you more... a real perspective on what's actually happening in the market.
Right. So to take that example and take it a little bit further, why would those other 150 be there? Is it accident? Is it design? Talk me through what's been happening.
It's absolutely designed to capture the lead, right? As a real estate agency, you want to capture the lead. You want to capture the consumer. And then once you've got that lead, you can try and sell them another property that's available on the market. So it in the long term, it will be beneficial for everyone. So we just have to stop cutting corners, really.
Are brokers leaving up real listings, or are these listings that have never existed in the first place?
No, some might be real listings, but some people also leave properties online that have, for example, been sold 3 to 6 months ago. Maybe the transfer hasn't happened yet. But as a consumer, as a buyer, calling that agency just to be told that property is no longer available or it's been sold, but I've got another option, it's quite frustrating if you're out of 10 calls, 6 of agencies are doing that.
Is RERA asking brokers to update their listings every 3 days regardless, or just those where the situation has changed?
No, so now what they do, they've actually... created another layer, let's say, of security. When you list a property now, not only do you have to give all the documentation to the land department, they also now issue a special unique QR code, a Tracheesi permit against that property that's unique. So if you don't have that permit, which is only valid for a 3-month period, and you have to renew it every 3 months, it is automatically renewed.
How much of an issue do you think this is? I mean, I know we've just had the hypothetical Meadows Villa discussion, but how prevalent is this still in the industry?
It's it was a big issue. It's still a big issue. I'm very glad that DLD is taking measures now to tackle this. I think I've heard from a property portal that in the first day they removed over 3,000 properties from a property portal all over Dubai. So it is very prevalent. It's all about lead capturing, unfortunately. So it will just enhance the confidence in the market.
Is the competition for leads growing at the moment? I mean, I'm actually hearing that the number of viewings per property that's for sale is going through the roof.
Yes, this is true, obviously. So as a real estate agent, what we want is leads, right? Leads is our currency. So the more leads we get, the better it is for the agents, for the agency. So we're capturing leads from social media campaigns, from property portals, from websites, from advertising all over. So now with the permit, that makes it harder to capture the lead. Even an Instagram story, for example, has to be attached to a permit now. So every agent that makes a post on Instagram, if they don't have the permit there and they're caught by the land department, they will be facing a fine. That agency will be facing a fine.
Do we have any idea what kind of fines we could be talking?
50,000 dirhams. And there were 30 agencies fined in February alone.
And that's 50,000 per fake
per
ad?
Permit,
or?
Per fake ad, yes.
Let's look at the other side of this equation, because as someone who bought a property nearly a year ago now, I'm now in the situation where I'm getting every week, I would say almost every day, either a call or a WhatsApp from someone addressing me by name and suggesting that I might want to sell it. How do they get hold of my number and my name?
They could get hold of your number of multiple sources, really. Unfortunately, it's just a lot of data that is passed around from different authorities and identities. But yes, it's very sensible information that is being passed around, and they have your name, you know, your nationality, the address of your property. So unfortunately, that's been going on for many years. And I think they're also starting to tackle that. They created the green list, which as a seller, you can automatically register for the green list, meaning they authorize any agent to contact you on behalf of your property. But if you're not on that green list, they shouldn't really be calling you.
When they call me, I give them your number as well.
there you go.
Just to let you know. I find it easier just because you've been in the market recently.
But it is, I mean, they are detailed calls. And, you know, the people on the other end absolutely know what they're talking about. They know what you own. They know
I'll give them a few details.
Thanks,
as well.
Tom. Could you not be useful and at least say she's a cappuccino and I'm a milk cappuccino?
I do say that, yeah. I do that every morning.
Does it work, though? So here's the, you know, 1.5 million dirham question. Presumably, people wouldn't be doing the cold calling and the cold WhatsApping if it didn't work. Does it pay off in presumably large enough quantities to keep doing it?
It does pay off, obviously, because... Well, in every 100 cold calls, you might get 10 people that might be interested in selling. And if those 10 people then transact into a listing and into a deal, it does pay off at the end of the day. But it should be more regulated, I completely agree.
Gil van Gelder is Sales Director at Espace Real Estate, speaking to us this morning about RERA cracking down on listings that are either fake or just hang around once a villa and apartment has already been sold or rented and is off the market. Thank you very much.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.